Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
I once shot hoops with Steve Nash in Battery Park City. He was just down there with his family, and I was just a dude playing pickup hoops with my friends. And I got there early, and this guy walks by in a hoodie with his kids in like his twin stroller. And I look up and I was like, I think my exact thought was like, that dude in a hoodie is fucking Steve Nash, is what I said to myself. And then, so this is an absolutely true story.
Was this while he was still playing in the NBA? Or
yeah, he was literally the NBA's reigning MVP at this point. it was like the MVP of the league.
What?
No joke. So I'm playing pickup with friends in Battery Park City, and I get there before my friends. So I'm just there shooting the basketball alone. And then Steve Nash, reigning NBA MVP, comes up to me and says, can I shoot around with you? This is the kind of thing that if you said this was in a commercial or whatever, you'd be like, this is total nonsense. Like, this is not the way the world works. Eventually, I ended up just rebounding for him because I felt like a total asshole being like, now I'm going to shoot and you rebound for me, Steve. I was like, you know what I mean?
Can you imagine Steve Nash rebounding for you? I can't imagine that at all. I would be just clanking everything.
Right, welcome back to Yang Speaks. This is your co-host Zach Grauman. It's good to be with you guys. It's a new day in the United States. We have a new president officially. Joe Biden was sworn in. We're recording this on Thursday, the 21st. So we recorded this right after the inauguration. And for those of you who are not Trump fans, that doesn't mean you're Democrat or Republican. You have your own situation. But if you weren't a Trump fan, today feels like a sigh of relief in many ways. And it was nice on a personal level, I think, to see some good old-fashioned boring politics. For those of you who haven't been tuning in, Andrew is basically going to be doing interviews in his schedule, given his general political activities. And you'll be stuck with me for the introductions. And I hope to keep them interesting. I hope to keep them giving you the Yang perspective on what is going on in the world. Now, before I dive into it, I hope you guys like this new merch I'm wearing. It is not officially launched yet, but if you like it, give me an @ on Twitter, @Zach_Grauman. Let me know what you guys think as we start to build out a merch platform for y'all to buy over the next weeks and months. Here's what I'd like to do on these episodes, because if Andrew's going to be doing conversations, you're not going to always get Yang's perspective on the news of the week and the issues that are hitting home and some of the more creative stuff or more timely stuff that we do. So what I wanted to do today is three things. I wanted to give you what I think are the news updates of the week and what's going on in the world. And then two, give you the Yang perspective, whether it's Andrew or myself or kind of what the Yang gang zeitgeist is. That fact-based, not left to right, forward, humanity first perspective for you, and then introduce our speaker today. So I think you guys are going to enjoy this. Let's start with the news of the week, folks. And the news of the week, the big one, a couple things. Number one, obviously most importantly, the Buffalo Bills are in the AFC Championship. And if you're listening to this, they may have already clinched a Super Bowl appearance. I don't know. I'm either crying or doing cartwheels. It's one of the two. It's fine. We're not going to talk about it anymore. But the Buffalo Bills, come on now. Big news. Second fun piece of news is Bernie Sanders is a hilarious meme at the moment. Bernie, for those of you who have not seen it, Bernie Sanders was at the inauguration and bundled up like grandpa is at his kid's soccer game, like looking a little over it. He's been photoshopped into every sitting photo you can imagine, from Game of Thrones to like a park bench to Civil War photos. And it's pretty hilarious. So kudos to you, Bernie. That's internet gold. I hope you guys appreciate this meme. But more importantly, let's talk about Joe Biden and what's going on. So, Joe Biden, in the first 24 hours, has already signed executive orders to issue a national mask mandate on federal property and interstate travel. So if you are on a flight, if you are in a federal building, you have to wear a mask. Now, for those of you or Yang Gang here listening to Yang Speaks who are libertarian, I understand you're like, government freedoms, that kind of thing. But guys, the government requires you to wear pants. It's for the protection of yourself and others. So the mask mandate, guys, in a global pandemic, not a big deal, not an infringement upon rights. If it wasn't a pandemic, it'd be a big deal. But guys, come on, we wear a freaking mask, please, for everybody. The other thing he's promised, to extend nationwide restrictions on home evictions and foreclosures. So those were set to lift. He's kept them for those of for a lot of people who are struggling to stay in their home in COVID. They're struggling economically. People not being able to be kicked out of their home, which is a smart move to prevent more homelessness. And I think there's ways you can compensate landlords and things like that to prevent everybody from losing money. But it is important to think of the human side of COVID. And then continue to pause federal student loan payments, which I'm big time in favor of. A couple things he's done to overturn what Trump's done. He has rejoined the Paris Accords. Frankly, looking at the Paris Accords, it's kind of fluff, but it is a good symbol that climate change is important. So I don't think that hurts or harms many things, but I hope that we prioritize climate change because I like this planet. I hope you guys do too. He's ended the so-called Muslim ban on travel that Trump started in 2017, restricted travel and immigration from a number of countries to the U.S., though those countries included Syria, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. And he's included a couple others in 2020. That ban is lifted. We do have normal travel restrictions around COVID, but he's lifted that back. And it was a pledge he promised to do, and he has done it. And he's expected, if he hasn't signed it yet, he has signed an order to rescind the permit for construction of the Keystone Pipeline between U.S. and Canada. Very controversial policy, particularly for environmental and climate change activists. And I don't think Canada is thrilled about that. But generally speaking, the international response to Joe's presidency has been strong, for what it's worth. His also plans that he did promise on the campaign, he hasn't done yet, but it looks like he will do shortly, is to rejoin the World Health Organization, propose an immigration reform for the 11 million undocumented immigrants and give them a roadmap to citizenship. He's planned to do a lot on climate change to achieve 100% clean energy, net zero emissions by 2050, transgender rights and the Equality Act, and a number of things in the COVID recovery space, which he's promised. So those will be coming down the pipe for you to kind of keep an eye out for, if you will. So that's what's happening. I will give you this in the Yang reaction. This is where we're thinking, guys. We have a great relationship, Joe and Kamala. I got to know Kamala's team in particular during the presidential run at a number of the debates. Their staff was always very great to work with and fun. Joe's team, we got to know more after we became a surrogate for Joe after we dropped out. I will say this. The relief packages that are coming down the pike and being proposed better include cash relief. They better include cash for Americans. And if that doesn't happen, Andrew will say what needs to be said when the time's right. Let's put it that way. He's like the worst politician ever, which I love. He's human. And so when he sees something wrong, he speaks up about it. When he sees a big idea, he speaks up about it. Not worrying about the polling, the political risk. You see that all the time. You see it, just follow him on Twitter. You see that. But right now it's important to support Joe and Kamala. They have a massive burden on their shoulders, the weight of the world on their shoulders. There's no global recovery without America. We need to lead here. We need them to lead. And so we will follow their lead and speak up if we need to. Last thing I'll leave with is an introduction to our speaker. So we got Kevin O'Connor on as an NBA analyst and expert, normally with The Ringer. For those of you who don't like the NBA, I think it's still worth a listen because they don't just talk about sports. They talk about leadership, management, big decisions. I love when Andrew's talking about stuff that's not always politically related because you kind of see how his brain works in a human setting, and you can kind of get a sense of how he would govern and what his priorities would be and how he acts as a regular guy. So I hope you all enjoy it. It's one of the more fun ones. I enjoyed it. Kevin's a fascinating guy. So tune in now, folks. Kevin O'Connor joining Yang Speaks.
Now it is my distinct pleasure to welcome to Yang Speaks. I should be on his podcast. That would actually be cooler. One of my favorite NBA journalists, someone who I've learned a ton from about my favorite teams and my not so favorite teams, Kevin O'Connor. Welcome, Kevin.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me on. How are you doing this weekend?
I am doing great. I'm doing better than this country.
of ours. Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's a rough time in the good old US of A.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're here to talk about something that hopefully gives us all a bit of relief, which is your day job. And Kevin, I got to say, it's incredible because if you imagine all the legions of young sports fans out there, so many of them dream about doing a job like yours. And I'm sure you've told the story in other environments, but how the heck do you get a job writing about a sport that most of us essentially follow for free?
I mean, it's something like I always wanted to work in sports somehow when I was a teenager. I'm 30 now. And, you know, I was like, maybe it'd be cool to be a sports agent. I wonder how you get on TV, but I never really knew how to do it. And then when I was 23, my dad recommended I just sign up for an internship at Comcast Sportsnet New England, now NBC Sports. They have those all around the country. And I applied for that. I remember the interview was like all questions about the Red Sox starting lineup and their pitching rotation. I'm like, I can do this. This is easy. And then it just sort of snowballed from there over 3 years to get hired at the Ringer. And the last 4 years here with the Ringer and Bill Simmons. And it's been, you know, beyond a dream come true because it's something I always imagined and dreamed of doing, but didn't know how to do it. So I feel very, very fortunate to do what I do. It's a lot of fun to, you know, make connections with people doing it.
So did you write about sports during like high school and college?
You know, I did some like writing contests in local newspapers and like in my fantasy sports leagues that I used to play in. I used to do like fake articles. So like I've always liked writing and always liked storytelling. And I look back at that time and it's like I was getting reps writing stories about my fake fantasy teams rather than writing, you know, like writing on forums and stuff about the Celtics. I grew up a Boston Celtics fan, very spoiled as a Boston sports fan growing up. And you know what? I was always getting reps, And I guess that helped me once I started as a blogger, covering the Celtics and then expanding, doing a lot of NBA draft stuff. So it's always something I like, just never really, you know, knew how to chase it. And once I figured that out, it sort of started a roll.
Geez, man, because your boss, Bill Simmons, I feel like is the godfather of Boston sports bloggers turned big time. The rest of it. So when you were like at the New England Sports Network, you know, you were producing articles, like how do you get, quote unquote, discovered by the Ringer? Because I feel like that's a very big call up.
You know, so I don't know for sure, but I've been told by multiple people at the Ringer over the years that they liked the NBA draft guide that I did. So starting in 2014, I started making NBA draft guides with my top 100 scouting reports of all the prospects that were entering the draft. I did that in 2014, 2015, and 2016 all by myself. And then the Ringer noticed that and they're like, oh, we could bring this guy in to do some draft stuff for us. So it started out and with them noticing that rather than the stuff that I was actually doing specifically covering the NBA and covering the Celtics at the time. But I think the draft is what got their notice. They noticed me with the draft. And then from there, they looked at my other stuff and like, hey, he's young and raw, you know, bring him in and maybe he'll improve over time.
We can work with this guy. We can mold him like the lump of clay that he is. So at that point, did you move from Boston to California?
No. So I grew up in Brockton, Mass. My whole life, Brockton, Massachusetts. It's like 45 minutes south of Boston, home of Rocky Marciano and Marvin Hagler. Grew up here. And I moved to LA in January of 2018. So about a year and a half into working at the Ringer. And then I was there until my dad got diagnosed with cancer in March of 2019. And then I was home about half the time until last December 2019. And I've been in Brockton for all but a couple weeks since then, for last year and a month. So I'm in my childhood bedroom right now recording this, actually. Get the green screen behind me in my childhood bedroom here with my mom now in Brockton. I'll be back in LA at some point, though, I hope, post-pandemic.
Well, I'm so sorry that your family has been struggling in that way. I mean, I hope you and yours are all right. It's been a really hard time for different people in different ways.
Yeah.
But I know, like, for me, I'm a bit older than you, but my father turned 81. And so, like, at any point in time, you like, try and appreciate family and the time you have.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's, you know, I wrote an article on The Ringer a couple months after he got diagnosed, just about, you know, enjoying the moments and, you know, cherishing everything you have with the people that you care about and the people you love. And, you know, the path, like, I feel like my life in many ways, both in good ways and bad ways, has felt unreal, you know, with the good, with like getting hired at The Ringer, having this dream job, talking to you, you know, the bad as well with my dad, you know, getting diagnosed with cancer and passing away after 11 months, my mom having open heart surgery during that, like that, none of that feels real. And then the pandemic, and now everybody is going through some sort of, and with everything else that's happened, some sort of what feels like unreal. It's not something that you imagine happening in your life. And I think that more than anything else shows how important it is that you really do have to just cherish the moments that you have with the people you love, because nothing is guaranteed in life. Like, nobody exempt from good or bad things in life. And that's really the mindset that I really try to have in my life every single day, whether things are good or whether things are bad. So that's really helped me personally, you know, with losing my dad. And I hope a lot of people, you know, going through all this crap we're going through this year with the pandemic and the amount of loss we've had, I hope people are able to find a little bit of, you know, joy with the people they care about throughout a year like this.
I hope so too, brother. I really appreciate it. Everyone appreciates it. What a time you and your family have been going through. This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang. So, you probably grew up a Boston sports fan, I'm guessing, growing up right outside.
Sure did.
I'm going to unpack for you my sports allegiance stories, just so we can level set. And then I brought you on so we can talk about my hometown teams, the Knicks and the Nets, and I can learn something from you. And I actually remember the first time I think I saw your work was the NBA draft guide, and it was probably The Ringer. So, you know, like the Ringer is like, oh, he's really great at
Well, the Knicks are always seem to be drafting high, unfortunately.
Well, part of it too. I mean, like, I would love to hear what you think of the young players. You know, on right now, the Knicks have more young players than the Nets. But I grew up, I was born in upstate New York, but I grew up in a suburb of New York City, and became a hardcore Knicks fan during the Ewing Knicks era, which might have been a little bit before your time. So it was like the early 90s, and the Knicks were always competing very hard, but then losing to the Jordan Bulls. So this was Patrick Ewing, Charles Oakley, John Starks, Anthony Mason, Derek Harper, that crew, Doc Rivers. Losing to Jordan, then breaking through in the finals when Jordan left to play baseball, and then losing to the Rockets on John Starks' horrendous 2-for-18 shooting performance. Coming back in 99 with Sprewell, loved Sprewell, losing again to the Spurs. And then things get really, really rough. Jeff Van Gundy leaves, and then the culture takes a very, very south turn. But I was a fan even through the lean years, the Isaiah Thomas years, the Eddie Curry years, like you name it. And then Linsanity struck, and it was like the greatest time to be a Knicks fan or a sports fan that I can still remember to this day.
Those are good days, good times.
Yeah, like so. I mean, at that point, it seems like you were just getting started. But what were your reflections on Linsanity?
It was just special, you know. I mean, special. I mean, like him going, you know, Harvard here, you know, nearby. It was great to see a young player come from that school. It was great to see an Asian American shine in the NBA. And that was, I mean, I had friends in school at the time that were like, oh my goodness, there's an NBA player who's Asian American and Jeremy Lin. And they had fun.
Imagine
watching
being
that
an Asian guy who plays basketball, seeing that stuff happen. I was like, this is like the greatest thing ever. Plus it's your hometown team. It was the greatest time of my sports life.
It was great. And you know, and like, just like, never mind like all that as well. Like just from a pure basketball standpoint, he was incredible. He had clutch moments. He scored from everywhere around the court. It was a memorable time for the Knicks. And it felt like that was one of those moments as a sliver in the last 20 years where it's like, oh my goodness, this team has a chance to be really special. And I was never at Madison Square Garden for any of those games. I think I've only went to two or three Knicks games in my life. But the atmosphere there was great, even when they were losing. I can't imagine what it's like in that building with, you know, a packed crowd when the team's good. Have you been to games like that in those moments? Did you go to any Linsanity games?
I did go to a Linsanity game. I was in the Garden for Larry Johnson's 4-point play. You're right that the atmosphere in the Garden was good, even in bad times. I was first in line for, you're not going to believe this, but MSG had $10 nosebleed tickets for Knicks games in the very late 90s. When I was a law student between 96 and 99, I would go and get $10 tickets. So the atmosphere was always great. But then at the apex, like during playoff games or during the Insanity, it was electric.
Yeah.
It was the greatest. and so at the end of that season, when we let Jeremy Lin go because of money, I just could not handle it anymore. I was like, this is the franchise that paid Jerome James $25 million, that paid Isaiah Thomas like millions for, you know, sexually harassing someone, it was just too much. And so at that point I threw in the towel and I said, look, I've been eating, sleeping and breathing the Knicks since I was a kid. But dumping Jeremy Lin for money, was just like too hard for me to bear, in part because when he was taking the world by storm, it was like the greatest period of my fandom. And then seeing it disappear in that way, I was so hurt, really. Because I thought, like, look, Jeremy Lin might not become like perennial all-star and the rest of it, but I was very confident that it was going to be our story. And the fact that it then became like the Houston Rockets story. So that was like a real change in my relationship with the Knicks.
And since then, there haven't been a lot of those stories to cling on to either. It feels like it's been missed draft pick after missed draft pick, you know, missed free agent after missed free agent. And it now is really the first time where we're at now with the Knicks where it's like, okay, things are developing.
I have not felt like I've missed anything since. And it's been like better for my mental health too, because, you know, and like I have real problems with James Dolan, him banning Oakley, him banning that fan. Yep. Like it's really like the opposite of the kind of team you want to root for. And so during that time, I was kind of an NBA homeless like fan where I was like, okay, I'm going to break up with the Knicks now. And then a few years later, the Nets brought on Jeremy Lin, and I was like, done. Like, I'm going to be a Nets fan. So I went to Nets games. I actually saw Jeremy again in person when I was there. And later, I became friendly with Spencer Dinwiddie and other folks who are associated with the Nets. So I became a Nets fan. And I don't know how many Knicks fans had to wrestle with any of these feelings over the last number of years. And I did keep up with the Knicks, but I'm just going to rattle off like a few of the highlights and then we'll get into what's going on now. The bright spot of the last number of years of Knicks fandom was clearly Kristaps Porzingis. You know, he gets drafted, overachieves like the unicorn. He's putting up numbers and highlights. I mean, he has some, you know, health issues, but he's a gamer. And then we trade him away for cap space, Dennis Smith Jr., a couple late first round draft picks. And you're like, what the hell? Like, if you were a Knicks fan being like, well, at least we've got Porzingis, and then he gets traded for a bag of chips. And the bag of chips then ends up evaporating into thin air because you can't sign anyone with the cap space.
You know what? That trade, Phil Jackson making that, I am still willing to bet that he partially made that trade because of a lack of trust that Porzingis can stay healthy at all. And so he's cashing in, getting some draft picks, right or wrong. That's my belief that was the logic, part of the logic behind that trade. And with KP now in Dallas, I mean, he hasn't really stayed that healthy. Like, that's the one major concern with him. But ultimately, for the Knicks to make that move at the time, they lost the guy that gave them hope. That was the one player that you looked at and felt like there's a potential of building something around this guy. And you know what? Hopefully for them, with those draft picks they got back from Dallas, they're able to turn that into something. It's just there's not a lot out there right now. And KP is going to come back and he's going to thrive next to Luka.
Yeah. So if you're a Knicks fan, and this would be my big beef as someone who's continued to follow the team, is like it's been hard to identify someone that you can root for that you think is going to be there. You know, it's like, and anyone you do kind of emotionally invest in, the person disappears. So I said last year, I was like, I think this is the darkest time I've ever seen as a Knicks fan. And then some Knicks fans actually like took issue with me. But I was like, look, at least before you kind of could tell if you were trying to compete or trying to build or whatever. But like this team, they use their cap space on a bunch of one-year contracts for a bunch of vet mercenaries who are going to need playing time because you don't sign a one-year deal and then say, sure, I'm cool, like coming off the bench. And then you had these kids who were there trying to develop, and it wasn't clear whether they would actually be played over the vets, like based upon just, you know, like their ability to perform on the court. So I was like, this team has like no direction at all and is going to have terrible chemistry. And some folks like came to me and were like, oh, you're being too hard on this team. And I was like, this team's going to be the worst. But then now they seem to have turned a page. And this is, I guess, what we can get into now is like the new regime. As someone who covers the NBA, do you develop any contacts or relationships with like any of the folks they bring in terms of coaches and GMs? Is that like something that you get exposed to?
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know anybody, you know, high up in the Knicks front office. I'm not familiar with Leon Rose or Worldwide Wes. But like when it's kind of funny, like being in it now since 2013, like I mentioned earlier, it's funny seeing people who were like lower in organizations at the time when I first met them now growing higher in organizations and maybe someday become GMs, or some may already have become GMs. And it's just cool to see those relationships develop on their side. Cause like they're, you know, quote unquote league sources or front office executives that, you know, but they're friends sometimes at the end of the day in certain cases. And it's great to see people's profiles rise. And with the Knicks, from my understanding, is with Leon Rose and Worldwide West and the guys there is that's a smart group. Leon Rose, when they hired him, he's somebody that I would trust in that role as general manager. I think the connections that they have and their mindset about how to build up a team bodes well for the Knicks. And with Dolan, I mean, he's not a good owner. He's a very bad owner, and some of the decisions that he made are quite despicable over the years. But one of the things I will say that could work in New York's favor is that Dolan is pretty hands-off when it comes to allowing the front office to do the decisions that they want to. In the past, that has led to some very bad decisions because it's been the wrong people in place making those choices. But if Leon Rose and that crew know what they're doing, at least they're going to have the leash to do what they want to do to build this thing out. In some teams, that can't be said, where owners are involved in every single decision that's made from a basketball standpoint. So for the Knicks, they definitely are trending up. I'm not so confident they're going to keep on winning games this season. They still are bottom 10 offense so far this season. Their defense has really carried them. Some of that is opponent shooting luck. Some of it is definitely better effort. But they're going to drop games at some point over the course of the season, like all young teams do. But overall, the team and the organization are trending upwards because of the development and the flashes that we're seeing from the young guys, and as well as the hires in the front office. So, you know, for Knicks fans, you know, there's reason for optimism for sure. Finally.
So two things you can say positively about James Dolan as an owner. Number one, he'll stay out of your way after he hires you. And you're right. Like that actually has gone very negatively for us.
Yes.
Because he's like brought out people who made some bad decisions.
Pros and cons.
Yeah. And number two, he's willing to spend. Like the payroll hasn't been an issue, unless it's Jeremy Lin, unfortunately. But the payroll hasn't been an issue. And he's willing to pay top dollar for management. I forget what he paid Phil Jackson. It was something crazy.
$60 million, something like that.
It's insane. Like $60 million a year. Yeah. I can't remember. It was crazy. but so those two things count in his favor. And if he hires the right people, I don't know Leon either, but I do know people who know him. And by all accounts, he seems like a smart guy. And Tom Thibodeau seems great. I know, like, I associate Tom Thibodeau with, like, the last real era of Knick greatness when he was under Jeff Van Gundy. And, like, I'm a huge Jeff Van Gundy fan. I'm now friends with Stan Van Gundy. And Tom Thibodeau seems like he's from the same general coaching tree. And his teams seem to overachieve. I mean, he plays people hard, but they win.
Yeah, they win and they try hard. And that's what we've seen with the Knicks so far this season. That's been the big differentiator between this season and last season, is I think more than like any system changes. You know, we're seeing them do some different things, especially with the way they're utilizing Julius Randle on the offensive end. But defensively, a lot of it is just straight up effort. You know, like it can just be contributed to that. Yeah, and that a lot of that comes from Thibodeau and the mentality that he instills in his teams and the way he empowers guys and really pushes players to try their hardest. It hasn't always worked out for him. It didn't in Minnesota with Cat there. It didn't even, you know, it worked a bit with Jimmy Butler. That was a pretty good team. And I think that's what you know, have to hold on to. It's about building culture. This season, like I said, the Knicks are going to end up in the lottery. I'd be surprised if they made the playoffs in the East. I know a lot of Knicks fans would be angry at me for saying that.
I think 10 teams make the playoffs. I mean, that's a pretty low bar this time.
Sure. Hey, I mean, you never know. You know, Julius Randle could keep putting up all-star numbers. He certainly looks better than ever before. But ultimately, for the Knicks, this year is not about whether they make the playoffs or not. It's about the progress that they make and showing that they're a competent franchise. Showing that you're a competent franchise is what's going to make a player want to go play for you, a star player. Whether, like, we saw this with the Clippers. The Clippers had a nice, you know, gritty young squad that fought, and then Kawhi and Paul George wanted to go there. The Lakers had Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball and all this young talent, and LeBron James saw that as a destination that was worth going to. And with New York, if they can put themselves in that same category that the two LA teams just recently did and show that, hey, you know what? We got RJ Barrett. We got Mitchell Robinson. We got a lot of young talent. And guess what? If you join us, you can win now. That's what the Knicks need to become, and get another draft pick and hit on that. It's about progress and showing that they can be a team that's worthy of winning like they haven't been the last 20 years.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. So Julius Randle has been putting up monster numbers. And there's an interesting thing about this team. I mean, you really have to attribute it to coaching because it's a lot of the same players. Like they're back. Knicks fans did not like Julius Randle last year.
Rightfully so, last year.
Is my sense of things. I mean, last year's team was not an easy team to root for. But now Knicks fans are looking at Julius Randle thinking like, wow, this guy is a monster. He's like putting up Westbrookian numbers. He's like handling the ball, making really sweet plays and passes that you're like, wow, Julius Randle could do that. Like there are times where if you watch some Julius Randle highlights, you think you're watching like some combination of like a bigger Westbrook or like even I'm imagining. So this is the name that I know this is not the right comparison, but like I've seen him make some like Magic Johnson type like passing big man plays and looks like not like Showtime Lakers. Not like, I mean, you know, I mean, like I'm exaggerating a little bit, but yes. Like, but there have been a lot of plays where you're like, wow, I didn't know that Julius Randle had that kind of vision. So do you think that Julius Randle's current level of play, first, what has Thibodeau done to like elevate his play, if anything? And two, do you think it's sustainable or not?
I think Thibodeau's done a couple of things with Randle. He's sort of using the Bam Adebayo playbook. And with what Miami has done with Bam, they're letting him bring the ball up the floor after defensive rebounds. They're feeding him the ball in the high post wing area near the three-point line and allowing him to make decisions. So part of it is the offensive usage for Randle, putting him in positions to be a playmaker. The other side of it, you got to give credit to Julius Randle here. It's pretty clear to me watching his game that he recognized the fact that he was just a turnover machine. He was a black hole at times with the ball in his hands in recent years, throughout his entire career, for that matter. And you're seeing now, anytime he gets some defensive pressure, whether it's a help or a full-on double when he has the ball in the post, he's looking to pass right away. And he's doing that in transition, doing it in the half court. And that's the big difference between this year's Randle and past versions of Randle. He's always had a bit of a playmaking instinct. He's just leaning into it more. And that's encouraging to see. I'm not so sure if he's going to keep up the shooting numbers. He's still turning the ball over nearly five times a game. Like, he's probably at his best when he doesn't have as large of a role like he does right now. But I'll tell you what, Randall's a guy I've been critical of. When I did my NBA draft guide years ago and him, I did not love Randle as a prospect for a lot of the reasons Knicks fans weren't happy with him last season. Defensive effort, defensive focus, you know, playmaking instincts, all that. But we're seeing the version of Randle that a lot of people who liked his game thought he could eventually realize. And you know what? It's encouraging. It's encouraging to see this because now it's about doing it over a long period of time and showing that this isn't just a flash. It's not an aberration, that this is his new reality. And if it is, that could be a player that you want to keep around.
It's so wild. I'm actually going to say, like, I'm a Julius Randle optimist. Like, I feel like if you've like discovered you can do this kind of thing against these teams, like, I think he ends up having like a, you know, really stellar season, maybe not quite at this level, but like, I think he's going to end up having a great year. So I'd say right now, Julius Randle, like, he's probably the most important Nick on the floor. But the most important Nick in terms of the future is RJ Barrett. And you just said something that really just blew my mind, Kevin, which is that you track these players when they're coming into the league as draft picks, and then you kind of like see their evolution. And so like, there's almost like, no, we should give you some kind of nickname. So you're evaluating them when they're prospects, then you see them in the league. RJ Barrett's easily the most important Nick because, you know, like the hopes of the future, number three draft pick, star potential. Where are you on RJ Barrett?
RJ's progress year one to year two is encouraging. You know, I think we're seeing the 25 plus point scoring explosions that you wanted to see more often as a rookie from him. And that's good to see. I think the defense has gotten better. The spacing has gotten better for him to get to the rim more often. ultimately, though, his upside is going to come down to what level does his jump shot actually reach. In the most recent Knicks game that we saw as of recording, he missed a ton of wide open jumpers, completely wide open jumpers. And that's a concern with him. What level can he be as a shooter? Because, you know, I hate to always just harp on shooting, but that's the most important skill in today's NBA, regardless of position. Having a reliable jump shot can be the difference between being an average player who doesn't get minutes and being a quality rotation player every night. It can be the difference between being a quality rotation player and being a starter, between being a starter and an all-star. And with Barrett, that's what's going to determine what level he reaches. And with him, we've seen glimmers of what looks like somebody who can be a franchise player, the second best player on your team. But I think in all likelihood, he's probably that third guy, unless that jumper, you know, reaches the level that it needs to. But I'll tell you what, though, like, he's still only 20 years old. And that's something to keep in mind. He is super, super young, and there's no doubt that there's raw talent there. Jimmy Butler, you know, who Tibbs helped develop in the past in Chicago, wasn't even in the NBA at the time. He was not. So Barrett needs to be given a lot of time. But still, that jumper and the development of that skill is more critical than anything else, because everything else, you can see a path towards it, him being very good overall.
Were you high on RJ Barrett when he was drafted?
Yeah, I had him ranked second, I believe, behind Zion, ahead of Ja Morant, which could end up a mistake. But I tend to would lean towards the bigger guy, which RJ is, rather than Ja at the time. I would rank Ja ahead of him now at this point. But I still believe in RJ and becoming a really good player.
Yeah, you know, RJ has shown a lot of professionalism. Like, it does seem like he plays hard. He's got a good work ethic. There's no reason to think that he won't work at his jumper. And, you know, if his jumper becomes even league average, I think that opens up a lot. So this is going to be fascinating, because the Knicks roster is replete with lottery picks of uncertain prospects. After RJ Barrett, it seems like the most promising young player is probably Mitchell Robinson, who is like a second round pick. So, you know, he's kind of found money, if you will. Are you a Mitchell Robinson fan?
At this point, for sure. I mean, his shot blocking is so fun. How can you not be a Mitchell Robinson fan? Like, it's so fun to watch that guy at the defensive end of the floor and the rim running with his explosiveness around the rim. He's fun to watch. I mean, the reason why he wasn't a first round draft pick or a highly regarded guy out of high school, he did not go to or play games in college, was really just because of a feel for the game and his ability to read the floor. And that's what he has needed to work on in his 3 years in the NBA. And he's someone who's gotten a lot better. He's probably not going to be like a 35 minute per game guy in his prime years, but already he's averaging nearly 30, you know, and he's a starter. And it's going to be nice to see him develop under Tibbs with more time together, because Tibbs is the right coach for getting him as good as he can possibly get on the defensive end of the floor. So much of development is about situation, isn't it? It's about, you know, whether it's basketball or no matter what it is you do, sometimes it's about having the right person by your side to help guide you along. And for Robinson, he's gotten better, and now he has a coach who is known as a defensive guy. So this can only be good for him in his career and his own personal development.
So what do you see as a ceiling for Robinson? Starter on a good team? Do you think that's a ceiling?
I think starter on a good team, you know, a guy who gets near 30 minutes per game. I don't see him as like a star level player, you know, but I still see him as a starter on a good team for sure. I mean, if not that, you know, an energy big coming off your bench, which is still very important in any league, in any team.
He is fun, and he does make freakish plays essentially every night. Like, you're like, there's one block where you're like, wow, that was, he didn't even seem to be near that guy. And then he made it happen.
Blocking 3-point shots and everything.
yeah. It's crazy. I love that too. Like, blocking threes, seems somehow more special. So a lot of Knicks fans, I think he's probably like the biggest litmus test for the last number of years is Frank Ntilikina. Was a weird one where I think Phil Jackson drafted him and then was like fired immediately. So everyone's like looking around like, okay, that makes sense. Let the guy who you're about to fire make your lottery pick. So then Frank is out there, and He seems very strong defensively and makes the right play. But to your earlier point about shooting being the most important skill, like his shot seems uncertain, but he's also very young. And it seems like international Frank Ntilikina is like a different animal than NBA Frank Ntilikina, which spoke earlier to just really bad coaching. But like now he's got a good coach in Tibbs. I'm wondering, like, what do you think of Frankie Smokes?
I mean, I've loved Frankie Smokes for a long time. I always defended him on my show, The Mismatch, that I host on Tuesdays and Fridays with The Ringer. My co-host Chris Vernon and I have gone back and forth about Frank Ntilikina a lot over the years, because he's somebody who, even right now at 22 years old, I'm like, if he just gets a jumper, he's got the defensive ability to be a player. Knicks fans know. Knicks fans know that Ntilikina is already one of the better guard defenders in the NBA because of his size and length and strength in the court and intensity and mindset that he plays with. He can play D at a high level. Again, it's really just about what level can he reach as a spot-up jump shooter, and how much better does his ball handling get so he can be a secondary creator for you. Like you said, he tends to make the right decisions on the floor. It's just about, can he create to be in a position to make those decisions? And these are basic things, dribbling and shooting. But ultimately, for some guys, it takes a long time to develop that. And I wouldn't be shocked if Frank Ntilikina is a quality rotation player on a championship team when he's like 27 in 5 years. It just wouldn't shock me. Some guys, the developmental path is not linear. Some guys, it takes a lot of twists and turns. And for him, it wouldn't shock me one bit if that's the path for him. I still believe, but it comes down to the jumper.
I have this strong feeling that Frank Ntilikina is going to be a quality rotation NBA player on a team that is not the New York Knicks.
Wouldn't shock me one bit. He's barely playing under Tibbs. Like, doesn't it kind of say something that Tibbs' defense first coach isn't giving a lot of minutes to Frank Ntilikina? That's probably doesn't bode well for Frankie in New York right now.
Yeah, that's discouraging, because I like Frankie too. The other recent lottery pick, which I think there were some like measurements that were very, very negative on him, was Kevin Knox. And Kevin Knox, he's in the rotation. It seems like he's one of the first guys off the bench. What did you think about Kevin Knox as a prospect and now?
Raw prospect. Coming out of the draft, he was going to be a project. And he was the youngest player, I believe, in his draft that year in 2018. And all that's still true now, isn't it? Still raw. Still a guy who doesn't look ready to play. And what a shame it is now in year three. How you look at the Knicks and their offense right now, how much of a difference a quality wing scorer would make on this team. Like I said, they're a top 10 defense right now. They're a bottom 10 offense in the league. Having somebody like a developed Kevin Knox would make this team look totally different when it comes to projecting them forward. But ultimately, his shot has not come together in the way that it needs to. Neither has his ball handling nor his decision making. And with him, he looks like another one of those guys where it wouldn't shock me if in his second team or his third team, he ends up becoming a quality NBA player. We've seen this developmental path so many times over the years, and that's going to be the interesting thing for the Knicks, because with guys like Knox, they're probably more valuable to the Knicks as a player to trade for somebody who can come in right away and bring something to you, because people I talk to around the league still look at Knox as somebody who could pan out. It's just a matter of the fact that his value has dropped significantly since he was a lottery pick just a couple years ago, and now it's just a straight up project.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm going to touch on the main player we got for Kristaps Porzingis, Dennis Smith Jr. He was also a lottery pick, had a really good rookie year in Dallas, or at least Goodyear counting numbers. I mean, I know there were problems with him. He got a lot of playing time and put up some numbers. His highlight reel is a lot of fun. I remember when the Knicks first picked him up, like, you know, someone sent me like his highlights and I was like, ooh, like, you know, like the dunk. Highlights. Yeah, he's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got athleticism. He has gotten minimal playing time, I feel like, in New York. Where is the league on Dennis Smith?
Not very high on him. The size, he's very small, doesn't have a big body, the decision making, the shot selection, defense, there's a lot of, you know, factors working against him in terms of being a quality NBA player at this point. He's one of those guys who is going to have to change who he is. You're going to have to see Dennis Smith Jr. over the years take on a more playmaking first mindset, you know, grinding on defense mindset, rather than being the person that he was ever since he was a little kid playing basketball as an explosive, you know, score first, you know, spark plug guy on your team. He's going to have to change himself. And that's something that may never happen. It's something that he's going to have to do by himself. And I mean, it's just kind of funny, like all these names we're listing with the Knicks, it's like so many guys that people loved coming out of the draft that they were super high on as what they could become. And the Knicks have a lot of the kind of really castaways. It feels like a roster of castaways, and some of them are going to stick. Most of them probably won't. Dennis Smith Jr., I don't feel great about him. Nerlens Noel, too, another castaway, a guy who was a top lottery pick who hasn't had the career people expected. You got to hope that the other big they just drafted, Obi Toppin, you have to hope that he's going to be able to stick around. And it's been an iffy start for him so far.
Yeah, so they both had, I think, some injuries, but have you gotten any early sense of either Obi Toppin or Emmanuel Quickley? And I got to say, Emmanuel Quickley has one of the coolest names.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, how could you not succeed with a name like Quickley and be like, Quickley for three! Quickly to the basket. Quickly loses his man.
Did you see Tom Thibodeau using the Quickly pun recently with one of his post-game answers?
That. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Tom Thibodeau loved that one. He was chuckling at himself. But with Toppin, like Toppin, he's only played one regular season game. So let's, you know, we're not going to overreact here. With him, he's an older prospect, played a number of years at Dayton. And he's, you know, got similar qualities to a player Knicks fans probably don't want to hear a lot about, and Amare Stoudemire, because the Stoudemire era did not go well in New York.
I will say, as a Knicks fan for part of that time, like, I look back fondly on Amari. I mean, you know, his knees had problems, and,
yeah,
you know, like, the length of the contract was a little long. But, like, one of the most fun teams, I was just talking to another NBA journalist who said, like, the two most fun times covering the Knicks were Linsanity, obviously, and the beginning of the Amari era,
yeah,
pre-Melo trade. It was, like, Gallo, Wilson Chandler, Ray Felton, Amari. Like, that was actually, like, a really, really fun team. Anyway, so I can see the Amari Obi Toppin comparison.
Yeah, the dunking around the rim, the explosiveness, the ability to do some stuff off the dribble with the size that he has. And Toppin can shoot threes at least an average level. With him, it's going to be about defense. He was a poor defender at Dayton, did not move laterally well at all. Not a rim protector around the rim either, because even though he's tall at 6'8", 6'9", he doesn't have the length or the ability to really alter or block shots at a high level in the way that you need a rim protector to do. But ultimately, there's no doubt that there's talent there from him. The thing that's going to be really interesting for the Knicks over the course of time is that with Toppin, one of the other players that they were really into around draft time was Tyrese Haliburton, who went to the Sacramento Kings and has really shined there, already making a lot of winning
plays. He's going to succeed in a big way, yeah, for sure. Yeah. He'll be in the league forever.
and you know what? Like, the Knicks made their choice on top and may very well turn out to be a good player, but Haliburton was one of the other players that I've been told that they were strongly considering. And Haliburton already off to a great start. I wonder if we'll look back at some point and say, well, maybe the Knicks should have drafted him, as we will with a number of other teams that had an opportunity to draft Haliburton. But I guess I see the mindset they went with. They went with Toppin with their first pick, and then they went with Quickley with their next one. Quickley being that guy in that role off the bench, you know, at 6'3", with a 6'10 wingspan, who brings energy for you, brings shooting, brings secondary shot creation. So rather than drafting two of those guys, they drafted the one of them in quickly with their later pick, and already he's looking impressive already. And with him, the main question people had about him before the draft was with the size, you know, can he develop into somebody who runs your offense more? To me, I'm not sure that matters. Like, he is who he is. He can run secondary pick and roll a little bit for you, handle the ball a bit. But the main thing he does is just bring energy and intensity. He changes the game in that way. And hopefully he can get better over time, more than he already is. But I like what the Knicks did in the draft. I like what they did in the offseason, for that matter. I think they have built what could become a competent-looking team. And already they're winning some games. It's just a matter of continuing this and continuing to play with effort.
Quickly is definitely a gem in the late first round, because realistically, a lot of these late first rounders don't stick, and it seems like Quickly is going to contribute. So that's like a huge win. That's already a feather in the cap in my mind of like the Leon Rose team. So I'm enjoying some of the vets that the Knicks brought in. I think most of them are on short-term deals. And I'd say like the biggest confusion for Knicks fans right now is, like, again, what does this team look like in a few years? Who do they invest in? If there was, like, you know, you had polls for Knicks fans, you know, a month ago, it'd be like Julius Randle is going to be gone by the time, like, you know, like, but now Julius Randle, like, might be a keeper. But then if Julius Randle's a keeper, then you look around and being like, does Obi Toppin and RJ Barrett make sense on, like, a Julius Randle, like, led squad? And Mitchell Robinson, like, the roster has some decisions to be made. But I'm really, really enjoying Austin Rivers. Like that dude just seems like a Nick. He's like, you know, just show up in like a positive way. Like, and Alec Burks, like, out of nowhere, like, seems like, you know, he's performing. Like, the random Nick cast off veterans seem more fun somehow than they did last year by a lot. Nerlens Noel, I actually kind of like Nerlens too. Like, you know, I mean, Nerlens had that freaking, I think it was an offer from the Mavericks that he turned down for, like, I mean, I don't want to bring this up for any, you know, Nerlens. I think he, like, turned down some contract that was worth tens of millions.
Nerlens could be a listener of Yang Speaks. It's possible.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Nerlens, if you're listening. That was a lot of money. But, like, but didn't he turn down some, like, multi, like, yeah, tens of millions of dollars?
Turned down a big contract and ended up getting not nearly as much as that.
But this team, you know, I really appreciated Austin Rivers' quote about, and I think you referenced this in your podcast. It's like, look, I've been on bad teams, and this team has a different energy and spirit to it. Like, as a fan, that's actually like a magical thing to hear, because, you know, you've been through the doldrums and you're like, oh, wow, like, this isn't the same old Knicks. It's like actually kind of exciting. Yeah, I mean, I do feel like the big question is, like, what does this team develop into? Who ends up becoming like a real fixture? Because that's been a real frustration over the last number of years. It's like, you don't know who's going to be around.
For sure. And like you said, there's decisions to be made and all these pieces don't fit perfectly. And that's, what's going to be so interesting to see over the course of time. What does Leon Rose and this front office decide to do, and which star players become available? Obviously this season has thus far been defined by James Harden. James Harden wants to get out of Houston. I'm not convinced Harden's going to end up getting traded. I think that the Rockets have a good group with John Wall, Christian Wood, even guys coming off the bench like a Jayshon Tate, who's been an awesome energy guy for them. My understanding is that, and I have this in my article in The Ringer this week, you know, it comes out Monday after we record, and there's a lot of people around the league who sense optimism increasing in Houston, that they'll be able to keep Harden around and he'll be content staying there. And if that's the case, who's the other star player that could get traded that a team like the Knicks could theoretically throw their name into to try to get into? And I look at Bradley Beal from Washington. The Wizards stink. They're 2-8 as of recording. They have a bottom defense. Their offense is horrible when Beal's not on the court. Russell Westbrook looks like a total shell of his former self. The role players have not been good. To me, the Wizards look like the team that's kind of on a path towards blowing it up. And with Beal, he makes sense for a team like the Knicks to cash in on some of those draft picks that they got for Kristaps Porzingis and their own picks, and maybe some young players as well. Because Beal's only 27 years old. He still fits the timeline of an RJ Barrett and the other young guys on the Knicks. And he's young enough and well-liked enough around the league that maybe somebody else would want to join along and play with him. Like, if Leon Rose gave you a call later today and said, hey, what do you think about going for Bradley Beal? Is that something that you would be in favor of for the Knicks?
I mean, of course. You know, like, right. Right now, the Knicks are still looking for building blocks, and like you know, like to me, Bradley Beal, like the odds of the Knicks getting Bradley Beal based upon what could be traded for him seem pretty low to me. Like, because I feel like if Washington made Bradley Beal available, like every contender would be like the freaking Nuggets could put up like a much superior offer to
the Knicks. I mean, I wouldn't favor the Knicks in like the Beal sweepstakes, but I think like they're the type of team that it makes sense. Like I said, this year about the Knicks is all about appearing to be a team that's competent. I feel like it makes sense for them to throw themselves into that to show that they can be in there in the race for those star players. And that's something that can set a tone and draw attention to the team that, hey, these Knicks are different because they are different. And so they need to show themselves to be different. So I think about it from a strategic point of view for the front office and ownership too. They need to make players and other teams around the league and agents feel like they are ready to bring on a proven talent, because that's ultimately going to be the goal here. It's not just developing young players for the next 8 years. It's going to be about finding the right star through a trade or free agency. They need to be positioned for that, and they're on their way. And Beal might be the next guy. They might not get him, but it's about being ready for whenever those opportunities become available.
Wow, spoken like you're whispering into Leon Rose's ear. that was a tremendous summary. Well, I got to say, this Knicks team is a lot more rootable than they've been in years. And any fan is excited just to be able to watch a team that you can enjoy, because the team has been tough. So I now have a big ask for you, and I don't know if this is something you can do, but do you have the power to switch your Madison Square Garden background into a Barclays background?
Yeah,
yes, you do.
Look at this. Ready.
Go, ground floor of Barclays. The Barclays Center. I came prepared. Dude, look at this. Everyone, you should admire Kevin's diligence. I mean, geez. So now we're going to talk about the Brooklyn Nets, my team. I actually was one of their guests during the bubble play, where like I showed up on like their video wall.
That's right.
Like, you know, I went to an in-person game right before they shut down, and the people in Brooklyn were very nice to me. Thank you, Brooklyn. That was a blast. So this season started with so much optimism. The optimism's still there. I mean, the Brooklyn Nets, like, you know, could represent the East, like, you know, like they could contend all year. But this team was stacked starting the year. Like, you start out and you're just looking at this rotation being like, wow, they go 10 deep. They're going to score. I mean, I think there was one game they won like 144 to 140. Like, the team could just score on anybody. They were a veteran. Like, we just got through the Knicks and like all of like the, you know, like lottery picks and whatnot. I mean, the Brooklyn Nets are a totally different animal, where it's just like veteran contenders. And then Dinwiddie went down, and this is really like the to me, and you look at it and you say, well, this team still has plenty of talent even without Dinwiddie. But then after Dinwiddie went down, like, they've had a real rough patch. They had, you know, Kevin Durant had to sequester because of some kind of COVID contact, which shouldn't be a long-term thing. Kyrie Irving missed a couple of games for personal reasons that, you know, like, no one really knows much about. we're just like
not even Steve like Nash.
just like shrugging and saying, Steve Nash. Steve Nash, like, first let me say I root for Steve Nash because he seems like a great guy. And I once shot hoops with Steve Nash in Battery Park City. He was just down there with his family, and I was just a dude playing pickup hoops with my friends. And I got there early, and this guy walks by in a hoodie with his kids in, like, these twin stroller. And I look up, and I was like, I think my exact thought was like, that dude in a hoodie is fucking Steve Nash, is what I said to myself. And then, so this is an absolutely true story.
Was this while he was still playing in the NBA? Or
yeah, he was literally the NBA's reigning MVP at this point. it was like the MVP of the league.
What?
No joke. So I'm playing pickup with friends in Battery Park City, and I get there before my friends. So I'm just there shooting the basketball alone. And then Steve Nash, reigning NBA MVP, comes up to me and says, can I shoot around with you? Like, oh, like this is the kind of thing that if you said this was in like in a commercial or whatever, you'd be like, this is total nonsense. Like, this is not the way the world works. But this totally happened. Yeah. Like, I have friends who then showed up and saw me shooting around with a random. And then they were like, And then they recognized and were like, like WTF. And I will say also that Steve Nash shooting around randomly on a basketball court in New York City, he doesn't shoot around like a normal person. Now, what do I mean by that? Like, he wasn't shooting like jump shots from various places. He was just shooting really weird, like off balance, one-footed leaners. Where he would like coming in, he'd be like leaning back, where he was like sort of almost like, almost like parallel to the ground. And like, leaning. It was like he was practicing getting his shots off with like 7-footers flailing around all around.
Getting
him.
Reps on those weird shots against, common men for under 6 feet.
Yeah. And I was just standing there being like, oh, be my guest. Eventually, I ended up just like rebounding for him because I felt like a total asshole being like, now I'm going to shoot and you rebound for me, Steve. I was like,
you know what I mean? Can you imagine Steve Nash rebounding for you? I can't imagine that. I would be such a nice guy. Yeah, I bet.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. I immediately became nervous and started bricking everything. But he was like a nice enough guy where he was rebounding for me. And I was like, this is like against the laws of like nature that Steve Nash is rebounding for my shitty jump shots right now.
The basketball gods frown upon you, Andrew Yang.
We've got Kevin O'Connor back to talk about the Nets post-Harden trade. So we were talking about the Knicks and the Nets, and then this colossal trade came down the pike. James Harden is a Brooklyn Net. Kyrie is back from his walkabout. The Nets have had real ups and downs on the court. Harden triple-doubling, doing his thing. They dropped 2 games to the Cavs. Kevin, first, let's talk about this trade.
Brooklyn Nets, I mean, they're going all in here for sure. 4 first-round draft picks and 4 first-round pick swaps for James Harden. Like, what was your initial thoughts, like from a fan perspective when that deal went down?
So I had 2 thoughts that were in opposition to each other. The first is, wow, you've just given your entire draft future. Like, I don't even think I've seen like that number of picks and swaps. Very, very extreme. And you gave up 2 of my favorite players from this this roster, Jared Allen and Caris LeVert. And they seemed like good-spirited guys, young guys with upside. They both were kind of developed by the team. So all of that's heading one direction. But then on the other direction, you have an MVP who wants to come play with your MVP. And that's about it. you look
at it. Well, didn't Jared Allen himself say it? Would you do the trade? Yeah. I believe Taurean Prince also was asked the same question. And he said, yeah, I would do the trade. So even the guys themselves in the trade would do it. And understandably so. I mean, it's bittersweet to give up those guys that were part of, when Allen and LeVert is part of those fun, gritty Nets teams with Kenny Atkinson at head coach the other couple years back. But I mean, this is a trade you do 100 out of 100 times, even despite this, kind of a up and down start we've seen from them.
I felt the same way. It's like, it just boils down to who has the best player on the court. And if you have like the 2 best players on the court, or maybe 3, if you include Kyrie. So then Kyrie comes back, and I got to say, you get these really positive young Thunder vibes from Kevin Durant and James Harden. And then Jeff Green, who a lot of people forget about, but he was like a very high draft pick who played on those Thunder teams. It seemed like there was some really good chemistry and camaraderie, and they came out and like Harden had this epic debut and they were like doing their thing. And then you do have to say that Kyrie comes back and then you're looking at it. You're like, so first, one of the things that occurred to me was that if I was Kevin Durant and I came to play with Kyrie Irving, in part because they signed together, and then Kyrie goes missing for a significant number of games. I mean, I feel like he missed like over 5 games, I think. I had to say that, like, I feel like I might be bent out of shape. Like, if I signed with a team and then like my co-signer wasn't there. And then James Harden shows up and like, you know, you go way back with him. That team looked really, really strong. And then Kyrie coming back, Kyrie's super talented. But it did seem like there was another adjustment that has to be made.
For sure. And I think it's going to take time for these guys all to build chemistry, even before the Harden trade. It takes time. I mean, they started 9-8. The 2010-11 Miami Heat started 9-8. And sometimes you got to lose or go through, you know, some bumps before you become the team that you have the potential to be. And with this Nets team, with Kyrie taking that time off for personal reasons, he stated that he, you know, didn't really want to get into. I'm sure that is tough, you know, when that whole team is bought in and sacrificing in their own respective ways. But ultimately, Katie and Kyrie, the fact those guys chose to play together, you know, says a lot about their relationship and their ability to get through any difficult times. And I think the fact that Harden wanted to go there and his relationship with KD is going to serve as kind of, I think, that like connective glue on the team. He's not necessarily like a traditional, you know, throwback leader. He's not like a guy who yells at people like Michael Jordan. He's not the LeBron type of leader. But for this team, a star power team, I think KD can keep these guys together through a time like this. And losing two games versus Cleveland, this kind of like, this feels like a wake-up call in some ways, because you got the Cavs that, like, this team just fights so hard. They, every guy on that roster is trying everything they can to win games. And Steve Nash said after, I think, Friday's game, he's like, you know, we're not a defensive team. We have to, you know, overcome that through effort and hard work and communication. And, you know, maybe for the Nets, it could be a good thing for them to drop some of these games here, because it's going to show the amount of effort they got to put into the defensive end. They can't just outscore everybody, even though they're going to put up a lot of points, and that's what they're going to really, you know, win or lose with is scoring. But their defense does need to be better, and that's my concern with them for sure.
So you say 100 times out of 100 you make this trade, and I agree. You know, they're in it to win it. Now it's clear, like, it's title contention or bust. Which I appreciate, because I think that anytime a team goes for it in this way, you kind of have to give them credit. Like, you know, I think maximizing your chances of winning a title when you're close to it is the right thing to do. And a lot of teams maybe don't take that level of commitment or investment. So you do it. Fantastic. You do have some concerns, I agree, and like the Cavs game sort of spoke to it, where you look at the roster and Steve Nash said it's not a defensive roster. So even though you make the trade 100 times out of 100 times, Kevin, and you were very optimistic about the Nets pre-trade, you were like, look, yeah, these guys could win the East and make it to the finals and play probably the Lakers. look at this stuff. You feel the same way now, having gotten a little bit more like exposure to them on the court?
Definitely. And you know, I think that Bucks game, the game they won, granted, you know, no Kyrie, I feel like that game showed the upside here, because this team, like, you know, their offense has the potential to be like an all-time offense. Like, when have we ever seen three creative genius scorers, you know, with their level of talent, be put together on the same roster? Like, they can play off ball. They've played with other stars in their past. KD, obviously, you mentioned playing with Harden prior, you know, Kyrie playing with LeBron, and KD going to Golden State, all the stars, you know, Harden played with in Houston. These guys can make things work. And you have guys like Joe Harris, who is just going to get countless open shots, and he doesn't need to be open to drain threes. This offense is going to be ridiculous. And with their defense, you know, when it comes to wanting to do this trade 100 times out of 100, you raise your ceiling and you probably, you know, make your defense worse. But it's not like Kyrie in some of those finals runs with the Cavs didn't show that when he's really given 100%, that he can be a really good defensive player at the guard spot for you. It's not like KD at his peak, you know, is not one of the greatest defenders we haven't seen. When he was playing the five for the Warriors, he can really elevate his play. And Harden, once a guy who people rip for playing poor defense, has become a really solid defender. He's especially like good on switches against some bigger guys. So the Nets, like, to me, I look at that team and it's like they need help around the edges with some of their other winged players with depth, you know, finding another big. They just signed Pell, who should help a little bit, you know, behind DeAndre Jordan. But finding one more guy, to me, can help raise the floor of the team, like, as a defensive unit. And, you know, their ceiling is not just, you know, one finals, it's multiple. And obviously it's hard to do that and need a lot of luck along the way too, but having these guys together like could just lead to some obscene offense with still pretty good defense with the right guys around them.
Are there any available role players? Because I know there's some free agents floating around too. Like that you think the Nets either are looking at or should look at?
You know, I had a conversation with an exec this week about that. And because we were talking about the Nets. So I was like, who do you think they would look for? Who are the guys out there? And what they said to me was this. Because of the league's new rules with the play-in tournament, which means, so normally in the NBA playoffs, 8 teams in each conference, 16 total, make the postseason. This year, there will be the 7, 8, 9, and 10 seed that get to play multiple games for the 7 and 8 spot. And the fact that you have more teams that have a chance to get that 10 spot, that means more teams have reason to win, less reason to let go of players. Players have more reason to be bought in and so on and so forth, which could mean that there's not going to be a lot of players available for a team like the Nets to go out there and get, like we saw the Lakers get with Markieff Morris last year, like we've seen with other, you know, teams with championship hopes get in the past. Because, you know, people around the league say the Nets are hoping that Andre Drummond, the Cavs center, gets bought out.
Oh my gosh.
That's what people say they're hoping for, but that's unlikely. Like, it's so unlikely because Cleveland's in it. You know, they're in it partially because they're pretty good, but also because they have more playoff spots to get in. You know, so we might not see a lot of options out there, which is, you know, I'm not really answering your question, but like, I don't know if there will be many options. This could be a really limited buyout period. And like, they don't have any picks. So there's not much they can trade to actually get somebody in return. Maybe a JJ Redick, somebody like that from the Pelicans. That's one
what?
Name. Yeah, JJ, I'm serious. Like, JJ Redick is one name I'll throw out there. JJ can stroke some threes for you. That would be great. Put JJ Redick.
I mean, that would be incredible. But yeah. Like, I feel like JJ is way out of their reach. I was like thinking of folks that, you know, might actually be available.
JJ could like, be. I mean, Pelicans are bad right now. They're bad. Really struggling.
Oh, but they need more JJs, not fewer JJs. I mean, you're right. Thing is like shooting.
You're right. Though I will say this, JJ, a free agent this coming off season, maybe the Pelicans would think, let's get something, you know, in return. JJ's from, you know, really not from Brooklyn, but lives in Brooklyn with his family. It would make sense, you know, to.
Wow, you're planting some seeds. Well, yeah, so, I mean, when I, like I think it. About the Nets too, though, it's like, I feel like, at least this is like the thinking you have. So you've got the three stars, Joe Harris, DeAndre Jordan, and like what you think is you need some gritty role players who will just go out there and throw their bodies around and pass the ball to one of the three stars.
You know, get out like, of the way.
Yeah, like, you know, you also got Jeff Green, who, yeah. You know, I think is going to be like hugely important on this team, actually. Mm-hmm. And so then I look up and I'm just like, who the heck did they get that kind of fits that gritty role playing mold who'll just like do his thing and like, you know, like not. I mean, and this is just me throwing something out there. This probably doesn't fit, but like a PJ Tucker type, yeah. Will just go and like,
that's a good one. PJ Tucker's a great example of what they should be going for. Cause then like you can play him with Jeff Green and play that and Kevin Durant have switchability and still have really good defense out on the court. That makes perfect sense. And, you know, I reported on the Ringer a couple weeks back that, you know, the demand for PJ Tucker sounds like 3 second round draft picks, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you know there are a lot of people around the league who think it is because he's 35 years old, because he's going to be a free agent this offseason, and because you know outside of the offense without Harden, let's see what he looks like. Granted, if he were going to Brooklyn, he would be with Harden again and be with other stars and playing off of them. So that makes perfect sense for the Nets. I like that idea. I think him or Redick or both. How about that?
I'm just thinking about like also like the street freed agents who are like out there still, like Iman Shumpert as an example, like just throw Shumpert out there and have him like, you know,
Jamal Crawford, guys like that.
Yeah. Bring back Jamal Crawford. Why not? Exactly.
I mean, it's true. There are some solid vets out there that could be worth an addition. But ultimately, like the Norvell Pell signing is sort of along the lines of what you're saying.
That it is along those lines.
We'll see if he sticks or not. He was pretty good with Philly last year in a real limited role when other guys were out, but you know that's what we're probably looking at in all likelihood for the Nets in terms of what they can add. But maybe, like I said, like a Redick or maybe a PJ Tucker, one of those guys could pop up, but we'll see how the market develops. It could be a weird year with trades in the buyout market.
Man, if they were to get Drummond, I mean, that would be like freaking epic, you know? I mean, like that's way beyond what I was thinking.
I don't see it happen personally, but I mean, it's just, you know, people around the league say the Nets are hoping he gets bought out, which we'll see, because his trade market when he was with Detroit was so limited. They had a hard time finding anybody that would take him. And it's not like even though he's having a solid season, much would change there. But I do think that there would be enough interest that one team would at least take him on for the rest of the season. We wouldn't see a buyout, but who knows? Who knows? Crazier things have happened in the NBA, that's for sure, including James Harden getting paired with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving.
So I'd say like the big thing a lot of us are thinking is that this team seems like a chemistry exercise or experiment now. Conventional wisdom is that if you have three stars, one of them needs to sacrifice a bit. And it feels like Kyrie is the natural candidate to sacrifice somehow, maybe because of Harden and Durant's pre-existing relationship, or like his relative, like size or something. Like for whatever reason, it just feels like that.
They're MVPs,
and then it also feels like the chemistry element is going to be key, in that Steve Nash is like obviously the key figure in trying to manage that chemistry. Like, am I the only person who feels like these two things?
No, I mean, it's definitely a big experiment here. And, you know, everything I said earlier about these guys, they could sacrifice and they can't fit because they have in the past. It doesn't mean it would work. You know, circumstances change, relationships change, and maybe the mix just doesn't work. You know, maybe they lose and these guys clash. Who knows what the future brings? But, you know, it's still, at the end of the day, it's 100% everything you're saying, that putting these level of stars together who, you know, are often isolationists, you know, you've given the ball, they run a pick and roll, the defense switches, and then they are on an island. It's one-on-one. It's like at the park. And that can be hard sometimes. It can feel like your turn, my turn, in terms of, you know, now it's KD's turn, now it's Kyrie's turn, now it's Harden's turn. And sometimes that can lead to stagnant offense. But ultimately, I feel like James Harden, when he was in Houston, the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, he became that, you know, ISO player, that guy who's, you know, dominating the ball. But when he was in OKC, he could run off screens and he could run off of handoffs and not have the ball in his hands and still be a threat. And KD himself went to Golden State, improved as a passer, became a guy who played even more off ball than he did in OKC. I feel like those guys have shown a willingness to do that when it comes to competing for championships, and that they can do it again here. And ultimately, with Brooklyn and Steve Nash especially, it's going to be on him as the head coach and that whole coaching staff to put these players in positions to succeed, and then for the players to play with the effort necessary on defense to complement what will be a high scoring offense. Like, this offense is going to put up points. Like, it's up to the stars to bring in that defensive mindset, to me, more so than the offensive sacrifice. Like, they got to be the leaders of the defense, and we'll see. I mean, it's a long season, but I think they can.
Interesting. So it's like a defensive sacrifice more than an offensive sacrifice that you think is being called for. I think Steve Nash might agree with you.
I mean, it's like the type of thing where, let's say you're not getting, you know, X amount of possessions per game, 30 possessions instead of getting 20. You got to put that energy you would put into those extra 10 possessions into defense. You know, that's what needs to happen. And Kyrie, I'll say this, like before his hiatus away from the court, when he opened the season, the first couple of games, he was really busting his butt on defense. He was setting a tone for the team, and it looked like playoff Kyrie. And I don't expect that over the full regular season. He's probably going to coast at certain points, as you should when you might be playing into the finals. But if he's able to turn back to that level in the playoffs, like we've seen him do in the past, I have a hard time seeing anybody beating the Nets in the Eastern Conference. Like, the Bucks have too many holes. Some of these other teams have so many holes. I feel like it could be competitive against the Celtics. It could be competitive against the Bucks and, you know, the Sixers. But I still feel like the Nets have higher upside than any of these teams.
Wow, you heard it here, everyone. Kevin O'Connor is picking the most fascinating team. Go Brooklyn. Go Steve Nash. I mean, I'm a fan of a lot of folks associated with this team. I want Steve Nash to succeed. So I hope you are right, my friend. Maybe we'll have you back to talk about what goes on a little bit later in the season. But thank you for shedding light on the Nets, the Knicks. What's going on with these teams? Very high level. Really excited for you to be proven right. Let's go.
I hope so, Andrew. It's going to be fun to see these two teams develop. It's been fun to watch them so far.
Yeah, well, thank you for your insight. Anyone who wants to follow Kevin's NBA commentary, it's theringer.com. You have a bunch of stuff going on, right?
Yeah, so I host a couple podcasts, The Mismatch with Chris Vernon on Tuesdays, Fridays, and then I host a pod on Wednesday, every other Wednesday on the Ringer NBA show feed called Ringer NBA Universe, where we talk about a lot of the young guys in the league. Well, that's a podcast we'll talk a lot about the Knicks, for example. Right on the website, The Ringer, and do videos and podcasts there. It's a lot of fun. It's been a good season so far, despite the challenges with Corona and everything going on.
Kevin O'Connor is where I go to get smarter about the NBA. You guys should do the same. Really, like, and if you look at it, he made his bones being a draft guru, dissecting prospects. So, you know, like, he's seen these folks develop. Thank you so much, Kevin. This is a blast.
And thank you, Andrew, and good luck. Thank you for doing all you do.
Thank you, man. Appreciate the heck out of you.